once that second dose had taken effect, I just knew I could see my two kids, my son and my daughter, and I could see my grandchildren. I have four grandkids. I could go over without my mask. We could snuggle, we could hug, we could talk and giggle.
That's Suzanne Rohde Ross from Seal Beach, California, one of about 46 million Americans who are now fully vaccinated against COVID. The CDC says that's about 18% of all American adults. Here in California, it's around 17%. But as more people get their shots and more businesses begin to open up, a lot of people want to know, well, now what? How much of our normal lives can we resume once we're fully vaccinated? And just because we can do things like go to the movies, go to the gym, eat in a restaurant, should we? We asked you, our listeners, to send us your questions about what we should and shouldn't do once we're fully vaccinated. And we have a panel of guests here to help answer these questions. Dr. Monica Gandhi is an infectious disease expert at UC San Francisco. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us, Joseph Allen. He's at Harvard School of Public Health, where he's the director of the Healthy Buildings Program. Welcome to you, Joseph.
Thanks.
And also, Omai Garner is here. He's director of clinical microbiology for the UCLA Health System. Welcome back to Press Play, Omai.
Thanks so much.
All right, so let me just throw it out to all of you, the first question. The CDC says, as I just mentioned, 18% of American adults are fully vaccinated. And the percentage of adults who have received at least one shot is even higher. So it's almost one in three, a third of all U.S. adults. So is the end near? And let's begin with you, Monica.
I do think the end of this pandemic is near. I think that essentially the minute that the Pfizer press release came out on November 9th about these highly effective vaccines, it could only get better from there. We had a terrible third surge. Now we got out the vaccine. We're getting it out, maybe not as fast as Israel and the UK, so we can look to those countries and see how low their hospitalizations and cases are with even higher rates of vaccination.
Omai, are you as optimistic?
I would describe myself as more optimistic than I have been at any other time in this pandemic. And so while I think it's cautiously optimistic, I agree that I think that we are on our way out of this pandemic, but I think there are a lot of questions still to answer. And, you know, I appreciate that while we may be further ahead than a lot of the world, getting out of this pandemic is really a global challenge and not just a challenge for the United States. But I am optimistic about what's happening in the U.S. right now, definitely.
Dan Joseph?
Yeah, not sure I have much to add that's different. I share that optimism. Everything looks really good in terms of we're quite fortunate to have multiple very effective and safe vaccines. And we can look to international data to see what our future looks like when we get a high percentage of people vaccinated. Things start to look very good, very fast. We're in a key transition period here in the U.S. And I'll also echo what the others have said in that once we're done with the U.S., of course, our job is not done, right? This is a global equity issue. And so we're just getting started in that regard.
Right. Okay, well, let's get into some of the listener questions. Becca asks, I recently received my second vaccine dose. Is it safe to visit and hug, that's in all caps, 2 exclamation points, a vaccinated parent indoors without a mask? What about attending outdoor events? And let's begin with you, Monica.
Yes, it is perfectly safe for vaccinated people to hug. I encourage them to hug. It's time to hug. my parents actually just visited me. They're 87 and 81, and they're here right now, and we're hugging a lot. Beyond that, outdoor activities, of course, are very safe. And we went to an outside restaurant the minute they got off the plane.
Joseph, in terms of airflow, we are told we should be outside as much as we can. Even vaccinated, should we still do more things outside than inside?
Well, sure. I think that's going to be the case for a lot of reasons. But I agree, once we're vaccinated, the risks are significantly reduced. And especially as more and more people get vaccinated, then the level of circulating cases drop as well. So the risks drop. But it's clear from the beginning of this pandemic that time outdoors is much lower risk than time indoors. And if you're going to spend time indoors, you want to increase the airflow. And I will say, take this opportunity to mention, you know, as certain things do go away, as hundreds of millions are vaccinated in the U.S., things go away, like plexiglass should go away. It never should have been there in the first place. But things like better ventilation, that should just stay all the time. We know this is associated with reduced infectious disease transmission in a typical year. So beyond COVID, there's some practices that should have been here all along and should stay after we get a handle on COVID.
Why shouldn't plexiglass be used? Isn't that an effective barrier if in case someone is coughing or sneezing in front of you?
You know, I think there are real limited instances where plexiglass is useful. If people are wearing a mask first, that's going to capture a lot of the respiratory droplets and aerosols, depending on the quality of the mask. And plexiglass is going to be good for what we call ballistic droplets, the respiratory droplets that really go straight. And aerosols go right around that plexiglass. And so there are some limited instances where I think this is okay and even useful. Cashier at a grocery store, that's great. Maybe seeing 100 people pass them in the hour. But you have to be careful with plexiglass in that it can actually impede or interfere with good airflow, right? The way buildings are designed, the way airflow comes in. If you start putting up barriers, you can actually create little pockets of highly concentrated air. And in fact, a new report just came out today that showed that. Showed first that within school transmission was rare when good controls were in place. They did identify a small cluster in the main office, and their subsequent investigation revealed that plexiglass was impeding the airflow exactly as we predicted. So if you're going to do it, you have to be really careful and thoughtful and be sure you're not disrupting good airflow.
Omai, I want to ask you to respond to another listener question who is also skeptical about reopening, asking, shouldn't we wait a bit longer to open up and mingle until more people are vaccinated just to see how the case rate is going?
I agree with that sentiment. You know, I think that, again, there will be distinctly different suggestions and rules for vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. But to be honest, you know, walking around Los Angeles over the last, I don't know, week or two, you'd think everybody was vaccinated by the way sort of people have dropped the public health measures. And so I do think we have to be careful, you know, and I think that it still needs to be emphasized that unvaccinated individuals need to maintain social distancing practices and masking, because as we've seen in a lot of other countries, and as unfortunately I think we may see here, there may be another, hopefully much smaller surge due to the lack of public health guidelines following by unvaccinated individuals because the case numbers are going down. But COVID is just right there. It's just waiting for more individuals that are susceptible to be infected, and then the numbers will turn around very quickly. So I do think we need to be careful.
What about the variants? There is some evidence that people who are fully vaccinated, and this is a very small percentage, it just came out, I think, yesterday in the New England Journal of Medicine, a very, very small percentage of people who are fully vaccinated are getting the disease again, are getting COVID. I think they tested a bunch of thousands of LA area healthcare workers and found that 7 out of nearly 15,000, so 0.04%, got COVID after being fully vaccinated. Is that because of the variants? Is that something we should be worried about? Oh my.
So, you know, I really think that when you look at the studies that ask whether people are getting COVID and they're vaccinated, the question for the study is, did they progress to symptomatic disease or were they just asymptomatically carrying the virus? And I think what you'll find is that progressing to symptomatic disease for COVID when you're vaccinated, when you're fully vaccinated and 2 weeks past, you know, your second shot is exceptionally rare, but could happen. We've had some cases at UCLA where it's happened, but it's happened in people that were more likely immune compromised than the general population. So maybe they didn't make an appropriate response to the vaccine, and that's why they caught COVID. Asymptomatic screening, when you just do PCR and look for carriage of the organism, there has been studies out of the UK that show that that is also dramatically reduced in a vaccinated individual, but it can still happen, which is why the CDC guidelines talking about vaccinated people going around high-risk unvaccinated people is really for protection against that potential carriage.
So, Monica, that leads me to another listener question. Danielle Williams wants to know, can parents who are fully vaccinated host indoor playdates with kids whose parents are also fully vaccinated, even though none of the kids are vaccinated? So should we worry about potentially infecting the kids? And what if the children are immunocompromised or have asthma or something like that?
Yes. So I do think they can have playdates inside with unvaccinated children. And the reason I say that is there have been many studies relevant to this question. There have been many studies in the real world, so real world, not the clinical trials, where the possibility of you transmitting virus after you've been fully vaccinated is very low. I think the best study that I've seen is the one from published in Clinical Infectious Disease from the Mayo Healthcare System, where people who are just asymptomatically swabbed before surgeries are 80% less likely to have even asymptomatic carriage in their nose than they were than people who are unvaccinated. And so I think there's no doubt in my mind that these real world studies show that transmission is much reduced after you've been vaccinated, which then goes back to the playdate question that to the all the parents being fully vaccinated are likely not going to be able to pass it on to children in the household. You know, children are very, very luckily much less at risk for susceptibility to severe COVID. So that's why I think it's safe to be in this household with unvaccinated children. If they're immunocompromised, asthma actually isn't a risk factor for COVID-19, strangely, severe COVID-19. But if they're immunocompromised in other ways, then I'd be more careful.
What if you're fully vaccinated, but another adult in your house is not? Should you be worried about, you know, your asymptomatic possible spread of it to that person?
In the same way that we were talking about, you know, how the real world data is showing us that after vaccination, you are so unlikely to have it in your nose, to have asymptomatic infection and to pass it on to others, that real world data has to be incorporated into our discussions of the vaccines, since the clinical trials didn't show us didn't actually answer those questions. So no, you're very unlikely to pass it on. By the way, you've been unmasking even when you weren't vaccinated, right, you know, in your household, because those become bubbles. But absolutely, I would feel safe being around your unvaccinated family member in the household after vaccination.
One more question from a listener. Mark Willis wants to know, can I travel out of state to visit a friend who is also vaccinated? The CDC, Monica, has very strict guidance when it comes to traveling. It hasn't really changed its guidance, saying only essential travel should happen. You should avoid non-essential air travel. What do you say to Mark Willis?
You know, I disagree with that in the sense that, you know, I understand that a public health agency has to be super cautious. And so I think it's hard to figure out all the things to caution against. But I do think that planes, especially because it's mandated, it's absolutely mandated that we should be masking on planes, are safe, actually. They actually have surprisingly amount of ventilation. And you should absolutely mask on the plane. Do not let down your guard as a vaccinated person. But the ventilation is very reassuring to me, the low numbers of super spreader events on planes. And I would feel very comfortable going and visiting a vaccinated friend on a plane.
Joseph, the TSA says that more than a million passengers a day are flying between airports. And so that's been happening for about the last 2 weeks. How big a risk is transmission in airports and on airplanes?
Yeah, so I think we have to separate out the two factors there. And I agree that until, you know, we're in this transition phase, and until we get there where the vast majority are vaccinated, we do have to be cautious. And of course, airplanes are excellent vectors for moving people around the country, infectious people, potentially infectious people. That said, you know, I've studied air quality on airplanes for over a decade. In 2013, I was the lead author of a National Academy's report on infectious disease transmission in airports and on airplanes. And I agree with Monica entirely. If you look at the risks on the airplane are quite low. And this goes back with decades of research and also from this virus. We're just not seeing airplanes as hotbeds of transmission. And it also makes sense. Again, getting back to the fundamentals, the air in an airplane is bled off the engine in nearly all airplanes, called bleed air. And you get about a 50-50 mix of fresh air from outside, virus-free, of course, and recirculated air. And the recirculated air all goes through HEPA filters, and HEPA filters capture at minimum 99.97% of airborne particles, and it's delivered right at the person. So you have good ventilation effectiveness. You get about 10 to 20 air changes per hour. For reference, in your home, you get half an air change per hour, a typical home in the US. So for those reasons, the time on the airplane is lower risk. That doesn't mean everybody should go out and be traveling around, especially those who are not vaccinated. And there are other areas of the travel experience that I think are higher risk. And this would make sense. In the airport, time in a restaurant, mask down, anytime that's the case, just like in any other restaurant. Also, you know, we flagged this in the 2013 report, and I'm not sure how many airlines are doing this, but when planes are at the gate, they don't always run their ventilation system. I think that's a problem too. We've measured carbon dioxide during boarding of airplanes, and we find that the CO2 concentrations can get quite high. And that's because you have a lot of people in a small volume space. And if those engines aren't running, or the APUs, the auxiliary power units, or gate-based ventilation is not going, you can have a buildup. So that, and I think about air travel, those are the areas that concern me the most. When the systems are operating, you have great airflow. And then now with the extra protection of mask wearing, I would consider that low individual risk, but higher risk from a population perspective if we have a lot of unvaccinated people traveling around the country.
All right, finally, saving the best for last. Oh my, this is an anonymous listener who asks this question. I've put a pause on dating since March of last year. Is it safe to date and do all the other things that are part of dating?
Wow, that's a great question. And I've actually spoken to some friends of mine that are not in a relationship about that. And one of them happens to be vaccinated. And, you know, I think that a lot of that is about vaccinated status. So if a vaccinated person is dating another vaccinated person, then they can interact in a pre-pandemic way, let's say. Mm-hmm. But if somebody is unvaccinated, then, or two people are unvaccinated, then it represents sort of an equivalent risk and probably shouldn't happen. So the door is starting to open, I think, for people to resume their dating lives. I think the challenge there is that, how do you know if a person that you just met is actually vaccinated, or they're just telling you that they're vaccinated? And how do the dating apps handle this? I mean, I think that there's a lot that potentially some experts can go down that particular road and how that's going to be affected. But, you know, according to the CDC guidelines, I would feel that two vaccinated individuals can be feel free to date.
So, like, on their first date, they should ask to see each other's vaccination cards?
I think it's going to be part of the conversation, right?
It's not very romantic, but anyway.
It has an HIV. I mean, it's been, you know, people see each other's prep cards or whatever. It's certainly been used, kind of vax sorting, we call it.
Vax sorting. Wow.
Call Sarah sorting and HIV, kind of knowing each other's status. And we've been calling this vax sorting in San Francisco, dating when you know each other's vaccination status.
All right. It's part of our new reality, our new world moving forward. I want to thank you all so much for coming on the show today and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Monica Gandhi is an infectious disease expert at the University of California, San Francisco. Oh My Garner is director of clinical microbiology for the UCLA Health System. And Joseph Allen is the director of Harvard University's Healthy Buildings Program. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter Elizabeth Colbert is here to talk about her new book, Under a White Sky, about man-made interventions to stop man-made global warming. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, journalist Elizabeth Colbert argued that the Earth is in a human-made massive extinction event, the most devastating since a giant asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs. And she argued that extinction would be humankind's most lasting legacy. She won a Pulitzer Prize for that book. In her new book, Colbert explores how, at this point, humans have no choice but to continue to intervene in nature. It's our only hope, really, to try to mitigate the steamroller effect of climate change. Just reducing carbon emissions will not be enough to prevent the wholesale devastation of most of the planet. And so here we are, once again, trying to control nature in the hopes of undoing some of the damage we've done in the first place by controlling it. The book is called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And Elizabeth Colbert joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you begin your book by talking about one example of human intervention with unintended consequences. And that was the introduction of the Asian carp into the United States. There was a real push in the 1960s to move away from the use of really damaging pesticides after the book Silent Spring came out. And this was supposed to be a responsible way to try to control nature, if you will, by introducing fish to the waterways. What happened?
Well, it's really interesting irony, as you point out, that this was done as a way to try to prevent obviate the need for damaging, in this case, really herbicides. So what happened was the U.S. government actually imported a bunch of species, several species of carp. They're filter feeders. All of them pretty quickly got loose in the form of what are known as fingerlings, these tiny little baby fish, basically, that could swim through even very fine mesh. And they've just taken over the sort of Mississippi drainage basin, this enormous drainage basin that covers, you know, 30 states. And in some parts of this system, this Mississippi River system, Asian carp now make up more than 3/4 of the biomass in the river. So they are just crowding out native fish. You know, Asian carp are just very, very successful, and they just basically outcompete a lot of native species. One of the species of carp is a mollusk-eating species, and there's a very rich and diverse mollusk fauna in the southeastern U.S., and many of these species of mollusks are already endangered by water pollution, by dams, and so introducing a very effective mollusk eater onto endangered mollusks, you can kind of do the math and figure out where that is going.
So you chose that to open your book, that example of the Asian carp, really as an example of unintended consequences, that even when we're trying to do good and try to do something in an ecologically minded way, not just use a bunch of dangerous chemicals, that can be end up being a bad thing overall for nature.
Well, we're intervening in these systems that are very complicated, and it's very difficult to anticipate what's going to happen when, and that goes for, you know, various forms of technological intervention, or in this case, you could argue, you know, biological intervention.
I mean, Mary Shelley warned about that, about man's hubris trying to control nature a long time ago.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And Frankenstein, the story of Frankenstein and the writing of Frankenstein actually does come up in the later part of the book. It's a very interesting story of why she wrote Frankenstein in a summer that was made very dismal by a huge volcanic eruption that really altered the weather all around the world, and including in Europe, even though it was about 10,000 miles away from Europe. So that figures in the latter part of the book.
Well, let's stick with the first part for now. And you also went down to check up on the coral reefs in the Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia. Tell us about how scientists are trying to engineer a sturdier coral.
Yeah, so corals are very interesting creatures. They're little, tiny, gelatinous animals that produce these enormous structures that are reefs. And assisting them in this endeavor are these little symbiotic plants that basically live inside the corals. And in return for protection, they give the corals a lot of food. And when water temperatures rise beyond their tolerance, what happens is the corals basically eject their symbionts. And as a result, they turn white, That's what coral bleaching is. And if the event lasts long enough and is severe enough, they basically starve to death and die. And so these researchers in Hawaii and in Australia thought to themselves, well, you know, we're not getting the ocean of the past back. We're not getting that heat out of the ocean. So what are we going to do? And the idea behind this project that I visited both in Hawaii and in Australia is, well, we've intervened in the oceans. We're heating up the oceans. Now we're going to have to intervene in corals and try to breed up or somehow create more heat-tolerant corals. Otherwise, you know, by the end of this century, we may be living in a world without coral reefs.
And all of the animals and plant life that survive and rely on those corals would be damaged, if not killed off.
Yes, presumably. I mean, coral reefs are really the nurseries of the ocean. Something like a quarter of all marine species spend at least part of their lives on coral reefs. So people have tried to calculate, you know, if coral reefs died off, how many species would be impacted. And the numbers are staggering. They range from 1 million to potentially as many as 9 million. So that's a huge, those are huge numbers, obviously.
Well, how optimistic are scientists that they can intervene with this engineered coral to try to save at least part of the reef?
Well, there are all sorts of other ideas, too, you know, that we will breed up hardier corals, that will maybe throw some kind of thin plastic film over the reef to keep water temperatures from rising too much. I mean, people have all sorts of ideas. How optimistic are they? I would say they are, you know, somewhat optimistic that you could save sort of these coral nurseries, and eventually when the, you know, humanity gets its act together and stops pouring CO2 into the atmosphere, then you will have corals, still have corals to reseed the reefs of the future. That is really the hope at this point. You can call that optimistic, you can call it pessimistic. That is pretty much the situation, though, I think. Mm.
Well, you just said that everyone's hoping humanity gets its act together and stops spewing CO2 into the atmosphere, but and maybe that'll happen. It doesn't look likely, at least not right now. But even if that did happen, there's still a ton of CO2 in the atmosphere. So what does that mean? Like, let's say we all stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, we would still have all these big catastrophic events, right?
If we stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, you know, the world would continue to warm up for anywhere from a couple decades to several decades. That's a somewhat debated figure. And, you know, we're not going to stop emitting CO2 tomorrow. I think that's a pretty safe bet. And we're probably not, you know, going to entirely stop emitting CO2 for quite a long time. I can't tell you whether that's decades or, you know, many decades, centuries. I can't tell you. But I think people who look at the way the political system works and the energy system and geopolitics, a lot of people would say, you know, we're going to go above these thresholds that have already been designated as the danger thresholds. That's sort of 2 degrees C, which is about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And we're going to just keep on going. Now, where we end up, nobody knows.
So the thought now, I guess, amongst many scientists in this field is that we need to get rid of the carbon we've already emitted. That's the only way forward. Like, we really have to focus on removing the CO2 that's already in the atmosphere.
I think we have to do, you know, the point is, unfortunately, we have to do everything. We have to stop emitting carbon as quickly as possible. And we also have to figure out ways to take out some of the carbon that's already up there. And that's going to be put up there in the next, you know, between now and when/if we eventually stop. So we need to do both of those things.
Okay, let's get back to Mary Shelley and Frankenstein. And she wrote that in 1816. And it was an unseasonably cold summer because a volcano erupted across the world, right, in Indonesia. So that has people talking about, well, okay, what if we mimic that event? right? That's what some people are thinking in this field.
Exactly. So volcanoes spew a lot of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, and it sort of drifts around. It creates these tiny little droplets that are very reflective. You reflect sunlight back to space before it hits the Earth, and that has a cooling effect. It creates these fantastic sunsets after a big volcanic eruption, and it also has a temporary cooling effect until those droplets also eventually fall out of the sky.
And what kinds of particles would be shot up into the stratosphere to make that happen?
Yeah, well, one idea is to genuinely mimic volcanoes, so to put up sulfur dioxide. That has downsides that include, you know, things like acid rain and potential damage to the ozone layer. Another idea that's floating out there right now is to use calcium carbonate dust, which is basically limestone. Another idea that was proposed to me somewhat in jest, but not entirely, was diamond dust. You could use these manufactured diamonds, you know, very, very finely milled diamonds.
You'd have diamonds in the sky?
Yeah, Lucy in the sky, exactly.
That sounds almost beautiful, if it weren't so
I know,
such a
it
horrific
does,
circumstance.
It does. It has a kind of magical quality, even though, as you point out, it's kind of horrifying.
And this has the very futuristic and scary title of solar geoengineering. You're really engineering the sun.
Yes, you're countering, I mean, you know, by some standards, we're already re-engineering the atmosphere. We've changed the composition of the atmosphere quite dramatically. That's why the planet is warming. This would be another layer of intervention on top of that to counter the previous intervention. And it has a kind of a Rube Goldberg quality that obviously makes many people nervous.
Right. What about trying to suck up the carbon that's out there and put it somewhere safe, like on another planet or something?
Well, oh, that's a great idea. That gets back to this idea that we're going to have to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. And there are many possible ways to do that. You know, a very basic one is to plant a lot of trees. You're going to hear a lot about that in coming years. The problem with trees, and I'm certainly all in favor of planting a lot of trees, is, you know, first of all, you need somewhere for them to grow. You need a lot of land, and then you need to keep them growing. You can't really let them die, or they have to constantly be replaced by new trees. And when they die, they will give up their carbon. So there are various schemes, once again, which sound crazy, but, you know, maybe they're not that crazy, where you would grow trees, then you would dump them in the ocean so they didn't rot, or you would burn them and make electricity, and then you would capture the CO2 that's coming out of the smokestack and bury that underground. So there are many possible ways to do this, all of which done at any kind of meaningful scale are a pretty big deal.
And so, as you say, every single one of these ideas comes with a whole host of reasons not to do it. Lots of risks, lots of unintended consequences, kind of the Asian carp situation writ very, very large. But do those pale in comparison to the consequences of not doing anything?
Well, now we've gotten to the heart of the matter. I mean, that is the question. And I don't, in all honesty, have the answer to that question. And it may be different from case to case, but that is increasingly the choice that we're confronted with and going to be confronted with.
Elizabeth Colbert, her new book is called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll talk about a local idea to save water and create clean energy at the same time.
By placing solar panels over the 4,000 miles of California's open canals, we could save upwards of 63 billion gallons of water annually.
That idea, next on Press Play. This This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, it looks like we're headed into another drought here in California, and agriculture drinks up a lot of our water. You can see it in the Central Valley, miles and miles of green where there was once brown. The California Aqueduct running from north to south, watering all that land. Well, here's a novel idea to address the drought and global warming. What if you put solar panels on top of the aqueduct and the nearby canals, shading the water and thereby preventing evaporation? Then, as an added bonus, we could use the energy created by the panels. That idea comes from scientists at UC Santa Cruz and UC Merced. They just published a study in the journal Nature Sustainability. Brandi McEwen is the lead author, and she joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it sounds like a great idea. Let's talk about the water evaporation part first. How do you estimate that these solar panels would save water?
Well, by shading the canals, it would reduce evaporation and save about 63 billion gallons of water annually.
Wow, that's a lot. 63 billion a year?
Yeah. And to put that savings into context, that's enough to irrigate 50,000 acres of farmland or to meet the residential water needs of over 2 million people.
I can't believe all of that water is lost just to evaporation. Have there ever been ideas before this to try to stop that evaporation? Seems like so much waste.
Yeah, there have. And I know the state is actively looking at ways to conserve water, but this is just a novel idea. And this has actually been demonstrated in India. So there's currently a 1 megawatt installation in Gujarat and a 2.5 megawatt installation in Punjab. So this isn't a new idea. It's been demonstrated in other places, but we have yet to demonstrate that here in California. But we see the potential to do that.
Right. And so this would cover the aqueduct and also all the canals that branch off it to irrigate all that farmland. So how many canals, how much water are we talking about?
Oh, yeah. So there's about 4,000 miles of open canals in California. The State Water Project moves massive volumes of water. So the water savings in context is small relative to the amount of water moved. But the reason we have this massive water conveyance like the State Water Project is to move water from where it's more plentiful upstate to regions of the state with water shortages. California is a huge farming state. It produces 2/3 of our fruits and nuts. And we make more money off agriculture than any other state in the nation. And so it takes a lot of water and energy to do this. And in fact, the State Water Project is the single largest user of electric power in California. So the potential to also generate power is also important.
Right. So let's talk about that part. How much power do you think under this idea would be generated by putting solar panels on top of all this water?
We estimate approximately 13 gigawatts of renewable power could be generated for the state.
And what does that translate into?
Oh, well, for context, that would be equivalent to 1/6 of the state's current installed capacity or half the projected new capacity needed by 2030 to meet the state's decarbonization goals.
One half of the new capacity that we need to get off fossil fuels just from this project?
Yes.
So this sounds fantastic. Sounds like a win-win-win. What are the downsides?
Well, we don't see any downsides to doing this project. There are challenges that can be addressed with some engineering ingenuity.
So you don't see any downsides?
I don't, but we do need to look at, you know, there are other considerations that we didn't look at. For instance, we just did a technical analysis, but we're going to need to do an environmental impact analysis. And then we still need to do some further exploration of this to consider some site-specific elements to really understand what the cost of the project would be, for instance.
Right. So there might be some unintended consequences when it comes to the environment or perhaps with animals.
Yeah, but we see a tremendous benefit to terrestrial ecosystems. But again, that was outside the scope of our study. So we'd really need to do an environmental impact analysis to understand the full impact of this on ecosystems that use canals. Yeah.
What about economically? How much would it cost?
Well, that's something that, you know, our analysis wasn't designed to forecast financial results. However, you know, our development team is working on estimating the costs. We recognize that not all miles of the aqueduct are created equal. There are different permitting issues, not to mention different design and engineering visions. So our team sees a chance to create something that is lightweight, resilient, beautiful in terms of how it interacts with the landscape. And like some of our most famous bridges, there's a chance to create something that's iconic for California, representing its status as a home for innovation and sustainability.
Hmm. Do you think that there is political will to do this, to at least look at your idea and consider it from California lawmakers?
That remains to be seen. But again, our team has been working behind the scenes to build the political and cultural will around the project's vision. We have been meeting with different lawmakers in parallel with this research study. So we are working on it. So stay tuned.
Okay. Brandi McEwen from UC Santa Cruz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we check back in with someone we met at the start of the pandemic a year ago, the quilting cowboy, how his pandemic stitching life has gone. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, in the beginning of the pandemic, we had a lot of free time on our hands. So maybe we picked up some new hobbies, such as baking bread, roller skating, maybe even quilting. Last March, we spoke with Dale Allen Rouse, also known as the Quilting Cowboy, who has video tutorials.
And your host, everybody's favorite quilting cowboy, Dale Allen Rouse.
Dale's internet presence may not be appropriate for children, the uptight heterosexual man, and the young lady in Sacramento who called me the drunk uncle of crafts.
He is an energetic and crafty YouTube personality, and his videos cover all things quilting. So 2020 was going to be a big year for the cowboy. He was working on a new line of fabrics, putting together his own TV show. That had to be put on hold. So what has happened in the year since we last spoke? Dale Allen Rouse, welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here with you again.
I'm so excited to talk to you again. It's been a year. So what have you been doing in this last year?
Other than just trying to survive.
Yeah, aside from staying alive and hopefully healthy.
Yeah, that part. You know, it's actually been, funny enough, a very busy year for me in that we kind of had to pivot, right? Like the whole world had to pivot from what we were doing to creating a new way of being, interacting, and being with one another. And that created so much opportunity for me that I did not know even existed prior to this, right? So like my sales of my patterns went way up because suddenly all, you know, people had time to commit to learning something like this, right? And so that was a surprise, right? And then I had a bunch of teaching opportunities around North America, and they all had to be switched to Zoom meetings, right? And online. And that actually really opened up a door for me to be able to teach more internationally, if you will, without ever leaving my house. I love teaching all over the country, but it's really wearing, right? And so that kind of cut that part short, and I've been able to reach a lot more people and how to teach some really great classes, even do what we call a trunk show, where essentially I show my work for an hour and we discuss the techniques used and, you know, the fabrics that I design and all of those.
Well, so teaching, I guess, quilting, you really do have to be in the room with someone, right, to show them how to do the stitches. I mean, it's hard to do it on Zoom, right?
It's not as easy as in person, but it's totally doable in that I have two cameras, one that I can show from directly above so they can see my hands and close up and what I'm doing. Then we also have usually a moderator in the class that I've reviewed the pattern with, and so can kind of help, you know, more in person if I'm not there.
So did you continue teaching quilting, or did you let that go because it was, as you say, hard to do, to took a lot out of you.
Yeah, I've actually been teaching more because the accessibility through Zoom has just created more opportunity for me to teach, like, you know, one day in Arkansas and the next day in Ontario, you know, and so that wasn't available to me before, but now it's kind of the norm. And so I'm having a lot of fun reaching more people and kind of being, you know, able to be more accessible, if you will, to a lot of groups.
All right, let's talk about your TV show. What are you doing on that score?
So this is really exciting. And I was actually approached by one of my former directors. I was a professional dancer for about 20 years, three of which I spent as a backup dancer for Celine Dion in Vegas. And so my former director for that show approached me and says, hey, I've been following you online and I really think that you have something here. Do you want to maybe explore it? Because I've moved to TV. And I was like, well, I've actually always seen this as a TV show. So yes, let's do it. And we got a few development producers involved. This started actually before COVID, and we're going along and we kind of had a production schedule, which has had to obviously halt for a while. We're anticipating picking up production a year from this summer, but it's going to be a really exciting craft show that finally includes men, right? And so we're going to be covering all kinds. So it's not a sewing and, you know, quilting show. It's a craft show. So whether it's we're, you know, reviewing haberdashery or distillery or tinfolding or, you know, whittling, like when was the last time you heard about the latest in whittling? Right? Like, I want to know, right? So this is the things like I want to uncover and discuss and go to their studio and really dive into, because I think there is such a need for crafts for all people, with men being a part of the discussion, which has never actually really existed unless it's a super kind of butch show, but it's not, you know, an overall craft show that includes quilting, that includes furniture making, that includes whittling.
Yeah, it's interesting that the word crafting is mainly associated with, I guess, what women do, or, you know, women's craft. It's not whittling and furniture making. I've never heard that described as crafting, but of course it is.
Yeah. You know, I've created my entire quilting line to be accessible to men and those who make quilts for men, right? Because at some point, all of us as quilters will make a quilt for a guy. And up to now, there's been really no fabrics or products that are really, you know, representative and appropriate for men. And that was born out of my personal frustrations of 20 years of going to the fabric stores and just being so frustrated that there was nothing that I really liked or that spoke to me as a guy who, you know, isn't really into novelty fabrics that has hammers and fishing poles and things like that's not it. Right?
It's a little on the nose.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I started designing my own fabric lines. And I just finished my second one, which is being delivered to stores first week of May.
Do you make really cool masks, like a quilted mask?
I do. And I have a free mask pattern on my website. So if you go to quiltingcowboy.com and hit the shop tab, all of my patterns are there, some of which are free.
All right. Well, thank you. And it's been great to reconnect with you.
Good to be with you.
Dale Allen Rouse, also known as the Quilting Cowboy. All right, that'll do it for us today. I'm going to hop on our quilted horse and ride out of here. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.